Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Jesus and Social Justice, Session 2 of The Ethics of Jesus, presented by Jim Hansen, number HAJ2003-02. Let's listen in.
I'm talking to God.
He's right there.
Oh yes, there. Burn it, God. Thank you for coming, those of you. First thing is, I was told yesterday that I wasn't quite loud enough for everyone, so instead of having a mic, I'm going to try to support, as I learned to do in acting class, support my voice from the diaphragm. Is this better? No, I am sorry for those of you who... This is a strange room because it's really hard to gauge. It's not a very big room, but the sound must all go up like incense. that's why we have cloudy weather today, probably. But I'm glad to see a number of you have returned. I guess probably preachers too, most sort of comforting passages in the Bible is John 6. We'll send you the tape. It's John 6 where Jesus starts off, it's the feeding of the 5,000 in John. He starts off with this huge crowd. And they're all there, of course, because this incredible miracle. And then by the end, and then he starts talking. And then by the end, there are only the 12 left. And he looks at them. And he says, "Will you also go away?" So it's like the more he talks, the more, you know, the fewer people are around. So that's it's probably a delusional comfort that I take from that. But glad to see a lot of you have returned. Today we're going to talk about Jesus' social ethic, and that's a pretty broad thing. All of these topics are obviously very broad. It's also some pretty challenging stuff, and I've had fun, although, you know, sitting on the porch of my chalet in this beautiful setting. I mean, I know you all know how beautiful it is, but it's like sitting in it's like being on the Discovery Channel, sitting on that. It's almost like TV. That's a little scary. No, but I mean, the animals and the deer come up, and there's these hummingbirds that are just dive bombing each other, and the chipmunks, of course. It's like being in a Disney movie, actually, probably more like. But. You know, sitting in this beautiful comfort and reading these challenging texts is a little bit should I be this comfortable when I'm reading these texts? And that's kind of the challenge I mentioned yesterday. That's kind of the challenge of Jesus' ethic overall. It isn't a very comfortable thing. Jesus does have very many comforting words in general, but his ethical teachings are challenging. And we concluded yesterday by sort of considering throwing out some possible ways that we might approach Jesus' ethics, both in the descriptive sense, trying to figure out what Jesus taught, and then in the normative sense, what we should do with that. And that's what we're going to do today, of course. Is try to get a sense of what Jesus taught in terms of a social ethic, and then spend some time reflecting on what we might want to do with that, or not. From yesterday's in the descriptive side of things, we talked about the different options that we had as far as. The necessity to sort of make a choice about which Jesus we're going to explore because of the four different canonical Jesuses plus the scholarly reconstruction of Jesus, sort of the historical Jesus, would be another option. I think that we're not going to spend a lot of time methodologically on that question, but I do think, just for a number of reasons, I think what I would like to be sort of presenting is what I think the actual human being Jesus might have taught, for a couple of reasons. One, I think the canonical Gospels are interpretations of Jesus for their time and place. I'm sure most of you know that. They were written for particular communities, so they're already sort of this second layer of, or at least second or third layer of the tradition, and are already trying to shape Jesus' teachings for their time and place. So it's a bit of hubris, perhaps, and we certainly shouldn't pretend that we can get behind that in a way that's sort of objective. But I think that what we want to see is Jesus, the real human being, making ethical decisions in his own time and place. That's what I would like to try to bring to life. And of course, it's only a reconstruction. It's only an educated guess sometimes. Sometimes it'll be very clear. But we need to see Jesus acting out in his own social world, I think, in order to really flesh out his ethics. So they don't just become, because Jesus didn't just sort of spout out timeless pearls of wisdom. He was very much, what he said and did was very much integrated into his particular milieu, as I like to sometimes say. it's clear, you know, the other piece of this here, so try to follow my notes a little bit. The other piece of this here is that, on the other hand, I don't want to make too big a deal out of the difference. You know, scholars debate endlessly about the historical Jesus, but there are few historical Jesus portraits that are radically different from the Gospels. I mean, they leave out a few things, maybe like the walking on the water, the talking fish, or wait, that was a different. but the basic outline is very similar. So it's sometimes I think, well, this isn't, you know, especially if you, especially the Gospel of Mark and often the Gospel of Luke with its social emphasis. A lot of scholars end up, you know, saying, well, this is what Jesus was really like, and then you read the Gospels and say, well, that was all there in the first place. But that's a good thing, and for reasons that, you know, would take us, you know. But it's a good thing to know that historians don't, right? Historians aren't uncovering a radically different Jesus. If they did, I think we would have some trouble. But anyway, that's what I want to imagine us doing, is walking with Jesus and being sort of over his shoulder as he makes some of these decisions, makes some of these statements, some of these actions that he does. And I think it's safe to say that, especially with the first three Gospels, that social justice is at the heart of Jesus' ministry. I don't think you need a scholarly reconstruction. I think that's especially the case for the Gospel of Luke, but also for Mark and Matthew. That social justice is at the heart of Jesus' ministry in his words, his deeds, you know, his healings, his table fellowship. That's something we want to look at a little bit. They all of those things challenged in fundamental and comprehensive ways the prevailing social structures of his day. And that is our goal today, is to outline some of the basic contours of Jesus' social ethic by examining some aspects of his life and his teachings. Now, we might be tempted to start off by summarizing, by some sort of summary statement about Jesus. And certainly one of the things that often gets, you know, if you were to describe what's the most important thing in Jesus' ethic, well, a lot of people would say what?
Love.
And there's nothing wrong with, well, there is something wrong with that. But I don't want to use that word to describe the essence of Jesus' social teaching, because, what might be wrong with it?
No action. No action.
Why? What do you mean no action?
Well, you can love someone, right, but right, not do anything about
yeah
it.
Love, at least in our language, I don't know if that's always the case, but love for us is often more of a feeling.
Emotion. Right.
Yeah, and emotion, yeah. What else? What else might be wrong with just saying that Jesus taught an ethic of love?
It implies that he didn't advocate accountability.
Yeah, love makes it, love sounds like sort of a blanket acceptance of everything. Yeah.
There's just some challenges too, and at least what you read to make you think about what you're doing each day. So love is sort of a softer version. Mm-hmm. It really is challenging people to think differently.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can recover the word love. It certainly was a word that figures into what Jesus was doing. But I just think it's just too kind of platitudinous, right? And you can love, you know, you can love someone or love something, and you know, it's sort of like the sentiment that bumper sticker used to see, like, practice random acts of kindness and whatever it is, senseless acts of whatever. Senseless acts. but that just suggests that there's just this kind of, but Jesus is a lot tougher than that. I mean, Jesus is not just about feeling good about creation and loving your neighbor and, you know, and that kind of thing. I mean, in some sort of, you know, lending them a cup of sugar. kind of thing. It's a much more, you know, I hate to use this word because academics love this word, radical. You know, everything's radical. But I don't know of a better word. And I don't know, and one of the things I want you to think about as we go through some of Jesus' teachings is what would be a good phrase to sort of capture Jesus' social ethic, if not love. That's kind of, I mean, I don't know. Something that's a little stronger, that suggests, you know, if you've been going to Jonathan's Bible studies, that suggests that sort of God in the mud sort of thing is a is it, or maybe it's just a matter of defining what we mean by love if we're going to use love. So think about that as we go. What do we have to do if we're going to be serious about understanding Jesus' social ethic in terms of his actual actions in time and space, in particular time and space? We need to know something, right, about the social world in which he acted. Of course, that's another huge topic, but we need to at least talk about it. In other words, we need to talk about the context, right? Ugh, brown. God in the mud. Context. That is brown. So a little bit about the context in which Jesus operated. The of course, where did all this take place? Anyone? Well, actually, that's sort of loaded. What do you say? Palestine, Israel, the land of Judea, of course. And what was sort of the? We can talk about the political. We need to know something about the political. These things really stink. I don't need this, believe me. economic, and of course religious. Just again, we're not going to get into detail about this stuff, but we need to see that Jesus is responding to specific circumstances, right?
How about social?
Yeah, how about social? Would that be a separate category?
That's everything else.
Comprehensible.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking. I'm kind of thinking. How would you see that as separate from these? Gosh, you know, the I can't even see. You're just this shadow.
That's okay. Are you?
This is the epiphany I've been waiting for.
Well, the social could perhaps encompass all that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Well, I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking, I mean, religious may capture the cultural set, but but there may be a broader cultural set there than religious captures.
Right,
that
right.
How about social context?
Yeah.
That's
for the whole thing.
Yeah.
For the whole thing. Yeah. Let's try that. And if what we talk about under each of these things doesn't, if we're leaving some major things out, then let's bring them in and we'll find
out. Where does the family fit into those three categories?
Yeah, you're right. Well, yes, you're right. Okay. Yes, because that is definitely, let's put social here. No, I think that's right. That's a good one. Because we're going to talk about families. It's a very important thing. It's kind of an interesting contrast to this morning, if you were at the Bible study this morning, that the family values of Genesis were Jacob, who pretty much sleeps with everybody in the camp, and then Jesus, who's going to tell us that, you know, we've got that our family ties are subordinate to our ties as brothers and sisters, as children of God, I guess we'd say. It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. So, politically, what are we looking at? This is all a review, I'm sure, for most of you. But what's the political situation that Jesus is born into, or into which Jesus is born?
Roman occupation.
Yeah, Roman Empire is, in terms of political power, the Jews are subservient. They're part of the Roman Empire, right? So, right away, you have this situation of domination. The Jews are not the people. That they are not serving the function that they were called to serve, right? Because they were called to serve as a separate people, but they are being dominated by the Roman Empire, which is since the fall of the first temple is about the fourth or fifth empire that has dominated them. So they're looking at these centuries now of political domination. How is Roman rule exercised in? Of course, the thing about I think we need to say domination, because obviously the rule was implemented through a very strict hierarchy from the emperor on down. And who was the how was it implemented in Judea? Who was the representative of the Roman government in Judea? Yeah, well, the Herod business is tricky. Because Jesus was born probably under King Herod, who at that time was Herod the Great, who at that time was the sort of the puppet king. I wouldn't say like King Friday, you know, just to illustrate. the puppet king. He was sort of the puppet king. He was allowed to rule Judea and Samaria, under the Roman. Under Roman sovereignty, right? So he wasn't completely free, but he was allowed to. But when he died in 4 BCE, or BC, which kind of means, of course, if Jesus was born under King Herod, that he was born in 4 BC, which is kind of a funny thing. somebody messed up somewhere. But we won't get into that. But Herod died, and then his kingdom was divided into four tetrarchies. Into four quarters, and his son in the north, I can't ever quite remember who was in the north. Maybe some Herod
Antipas.
Thank you. Herod Antipas did pretty well, and he was allowed to hang on to his reign. But the one who was reigning over Judea, where Jerusalem was, did not perform up to Roman standards, and he was removed, and it was replaced by the office of the procurator. So the procurator was the one who had jurisdiction over Judea. But in Samaria, it was Herod. So when you read about Herod in the Gospels, in Jesus' adult life, they're talking about Herod Antipas in Tiberias and in Galilee. So the procurator, and of course the procurator from 26 to 36 was Pilate. Okay, we don't want to get bogged down here, which would be easy to do. But so politically, you have a politics of domination. The Roman Empire, for its, you know, it was an empire, and it ruled with a heavy hand. We're not going to get into anything more than that. There are PBS specials to consult if you want to. there's that new mini series. Anyone watch any of that? Caesar? I guess it was pretty silly. Economically.
Well, one thing about the political piece is that the Romans, I don't believe, remove people from their homeland as the Babylonians had done.
Right.
So they left people.
Sure.
So the indigenous population remained indigenous.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. And they weren't completely. The thing is, they, as long as you acknowledge Roman sovereignty, you could you know, you could have some sort of independence. Part of the rub, of course, was the whole idea of the emperor cult. That would especially get troublesome for the early church. Jews had special laws that under some emperors, and emperors varied widely. But ever since the Persians conquered the Babylonians, the Jews were allowed then to live in their land. So the Romans were, you know, it's a complicated issue. Were they an evil empire, or were they somehow benevolent to some extent? But clearly, I mean, what's going to happen in a couple decades after Jesus' death is that there's going to be a major revolt that's going to result in the destruction of Jerusalem. So obviously things weren't, copacetic. Is that where you... and the word nonplussed. You never can use the word nonplussed with confidence, because it means the opposite of what it sounds like, right? Anyway, economically, again, just briefly, obviously it was not a land of economic equity. There was gross inequity. In fact, probably not too strong a word to say that basically what you have, both politically and economically, is this pyramid where you've got the upper, the power and the wealth resides up here, and supporting that whole structure are laborers and slaves and that kind of thing. So that the vast majority, you know, are living hand to mouth, and a tiny minority reside the power and wealth. Now the religious context is of course complicated for Jesus' immediate environment. Of course, Jesus was a Jew, right? That's one of the fundamental. It's one of the most obvious things, but one of the easiest things to forget or to forget to take into account as we consider his life. We'll say more about that in just a minute. But yeah, the problem with the religious world is that to the degree that it could exercise some independence, it had to be in collusion with the Roman Empire. So the religious world, in terms of the authorities, and this would be, I suppose, from Jesus' perspective, but the authorities were more or less seeing religion as legitimizing the present social structure, more than challenging. So religion was serving religious system was really in terms of the temple, which was the seat of the authority. What authority the Jews had was centered in the temple and the temple establishment, and they held power as long as they did not displease the Romans. So they were in that sense sort of in collusion with the Roman Empire to the degree that they had some independence. For example, other ways that religion legitimated the present order was that, you know, if you were poor, why were you poor? If you were on the bottom of this social ladder, why were you there? Or bottom of this pyramid?
You were born there.
Huh?
You were born there.
Well, and of course, none of this happened by accident. Why would you be at the bottom of? Why would you be sort of at the bottom? Why would you be? Why would you be poor? Why would you be suffering, either physically or economically?
Because you displeased God. Yeah, God did not look on you favorably.
Right. Because I mean, the equation was that those things happened because of God's. Displeasure with you. They were not so that the religious system allowed, sort of legitimated the social order in which the social sphere really, I suppose, and this gets, see, the religious and the social, of course, blend very closely together, but the social sphere This, at the center of the Jewish social structure is the idea of purity, as I'm sure you have heard before. The idea of purity, meaning that society was really divided up into categories ranging from the ritually pure to the unclean. And of course, the unclean, in terms of unclean, you had women, especially women who were menstruating or had some other flow of blood. You had lepers, you know, all the categories from Leviticus that get kind of, if you've read those chapters, they're kind of gross. They talk about, you know, the sores that you have that can render you unclean and all that stuff. But that served to sort of underscore the overall sort of pyramid. It served to sort of to legitimate. So it was not a very just, happy, equitable society. And it was also one that had this theological tension between Israel's call by God to be this chosen people through whom blessing was going to come to the whole world, and the reality that they were under foreign domination. So there was this powerful mix. It was a very explosive time. And again, just to recall that a few decades later, the whole thing would explode in a revolt that would result in the destruction of Jerusalem and the Second Temple. So, you know, if you can oversimplify, a politics of domination, an economics of exploitation, and a religion of legitimate, and if we can just blend this together, we are going to talk about the family in just a minute, although we want to mention right now that, of course, like all most ancient societies, first century Judea was very much a patriarchal society. So how does Jesus respond to this? And what we need to do to talk about that is to have, first of all, a little bit of an outline of Jesus' life. Well, any questions or any comments about that?
One piece that kind of sits between those is, seems like the Roman Empire, its success or its, and also its weakness is that it's built on taxes.
Right.
That's the
main. Yep.
Way that they dominate.
Yeah. Right, and that becomes, yeah, you're right, that becomes very key. I would put that in, you know, that's sort of the mortar here for these bricks, is the taxation system, which is very oppressive. Other thoughts, other comments?
How much did the religious system buy into that, the leadership at least,
right,
at the top, buy into that system of taxation?
Well, that's not something I can answer in detail. Other than to say, to the extent that they needed to, in order to keep the Romans out of their business. So there was a temple tax, and there were unscrupulous Jews who took advantage of their fellow Jews who had positions of. But they were tax collectors. You know, that's why they were despised.
Wasn't Matthew a tax collector?
Yeah. Well, that's the there was Levi the tax collector, and some people associate him with the Gospel of Matthew. Yeah. But Jesus hung around with tax collectors and other sinners, as we'll see.
Just real quick, you're saying that the purity and the and the hierarchy of purity was sort of dominating the religious social structure. Are there sources for that other than the books? I mean,
probably the best. Yeah, the best. Well, it's a little tricky. The best source would be the Mishnah, the Mishnah, which was actually the codified a century or two after. Mm-hmm. It was codified around 200. But there's a passage there that really does this exactly. You've got the priests, then you've got all Israel, then you've got Israelite men, then you've got Gentiles, then you've got, you know, it goes in that sort of order. Moreover, the temple itself was divided into that sort of sphere of holiness. It was divided in, it looked just like this too. it was divided into spheres of holiness so that you had the court of the Gentiles, only Gentiles could go here. Then you had the court of the, you know, Israelite men or something. Then you had the court of the priests, and then you had the place that only the high priest could go. So it was a very central idea. It's the central idea. And it worked its way politically and socially through the culture.
The Mormon Church has a configuration not dissimilar from that even today, don't
they? I'd have to defer to someone on that. But it sounds kind of a certain status to go to
a certain place.
Yeah. And this doesn't, you know, the interesting thing is this doesn't have to do with salvation. I think that's important to point out. I don't think it's not that you couldn't be saved if you weren't unclean. This has to do more with sanctification, with the idea that Israel was to be a holy place, a holy people. Why? Because God needed a holy place to dwell on the earth. That's sort of the logic behind the purity system, and it's good to point that out, because otherwise we can just make it this bogey thing. Because Jews still find this category to be a helpful category, and it's important as Christians that we don't just say, well, you know, this is a bunch of malarkey, you know, all this holiness and all of this ritual stuff about only eating certain kinds of things and all this kind of, that Jesus came and sort of dismissed all that and made it irrelevant. Well, made it irrelevant for, ultimately for the church, but there are still Jews who find this to be a very powerful means of living out their covenant existence with God. So it's important that we see that but a big part of the logic of it is to create a space where the holy God can dwell. And when Israel is polluted, God leaves Israel, and then all hell breaks loose. And that's also the place where God is in creation. That's part of Israel's mission to the world, is to be a people where God can dwell in the midst of creation and continue God's creative activity. Without that, God flees, and as I said, chaos breaks out. So there is a pretty profound kind of logic underneath this. The thing is, what Jesus comes and does is challenge the definition of holiness. Challenge, and does so not from some kind of new Christian perspective. You know, Jesus was not a Christian, let's remember that. Jesus was a Jew. Jesus comes at this whole social situation not with some brand new idea revealed, you know, from God, you know, this idea of love transcending all of this stuff and making the Old Testament old. No, he comes at it as a Jew with more or less carrying on a discussion that was already going on in the Hebrew Bible, in the Bible of his time. So let's look at that. And I think it's really important to recognize that. He's not coming on the scene with a new ethic that directly from God that supersedes everything that God has ever said before. He's coming in the midst of an argument. All right, so let's look at that. I think before we start sort of listing things about Jesus' mission and message, I think the most important thing to have in mind, in the back of our minds, is that the best way to understand Jesus' life is from the perspective of his death. If we're going to truly set his life in context, we need to be able to explain why these power structures, both the political and the religious, ended up colluding to bring about his death. He did and said some things that got somebody thinking that he was a threat to those structures. That's why they did away with him. Again, that's a very this worldly way to look at Jesus' death. But I think it's necessary and right to ask that question. Not to the exclusion of the whole idea that Jesus' death was God's gift to humanity, but as a helpful complement to that. Jesus' mission and message. So let's just get a few of some of the main themes of Jesus' message out here. And we want to be sure to save some time to... But anytime you have questions, obviously, write them down and submit them to me. my secretary. And as time permits in my business schedule, I will get to them. No, if you have anything at all, and if you, is my volume better today? I hope so, because it's wearing me out. All right, there's a great story. The basic thing, as I said, to remember about Jesus, or a basic thing to remember about Jesus, was that he was a Jew. There's a great story that sort of, I'm not a very good storyteller, but this one I think is pretty good. That it's the church, the final messianic banquet is often envisioned as a wedding, right? Like and the church is the bride and Christ is the groom, and so they're all gathered for this wedding, and three very obviously Orthodox looking Jews show up at the door, and the usher says, "What are you doing here?" And they, of course, said, "Well, we're from the groom's side." that's one of those really revealing, it's more than just a funny joke. It's like, well, duh. It kind of brings home that idea that we forget that Jesus was a Jew and that shaped everything that he did. I want to talk about Jesus in sort of six strokes. I don't know if we'll get through them all, because I don't want to just talk the whole time. But the first one, I think, the most important category to understand Jesus, and this arises directly out of his Jewishness, is that Jesus was a prophet. I want to get rid of this brown. I like blue. That Jesus was a prophet. And what we mean, this encompasses so much of what he was. What do we mean by this? In two senses, both in terms of maintaining or driving home or recapturing, however you want to put it, the prophet's passion for justice, as well as, and secondly, the prophet's he was a prophet of the reign of God. In that classic prophetic sense as well. That's a big issue. We won't get into in detail, but let's talk about those two senses. First of all, the thing is, when we think of especially the Hebrew prophets, we tend to think, especially as Christians, we tend to think of their function primarily as what? What do the Old Testament prophets do? They foretell what?
The future.
Jesus. Yeah, and specifically what?
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus coming, right. That's how the Bible is, the Christian Bible is set up. The prophets are at the end of the Christian Old Testament as a way of showing how they prepare the way for, right? They predict the coming of the Messiah, and Jesus is the Messiah. In the Jewish canon, the prophets are second. They're after the Torah, after the Pentateuch. Because the prophets' other function in their time, certainly, their main function is to call Israel to task for the ways in which it has not kept the covenant. And so they sort of proclaim God's passion for justice. The thing that they saw, the thing that the ancient prophets saw, like Amos and Isaiah, what they saw was precisely this, that Israel, if you've ever seen Dan Erlander, is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He does that great. This is his thing. Right? He's the one who did, what's that called again? The manna? The cartoon thing in the Bible? It's really great. He's got a great illustration of this pyramid here. That Israel had become the very thing that God had tried to liberate it from. It had become just like the Egyptian empire that God had, from which God had liberated it. And God was a little upset about this. And the prophets came in with some, extremely powerful words. Some of the most famous words, like Amos's famous passage about about how, you know, I despise the noise of your harps and your religious rituals make me want to puke. But because you are not practicing justice, your community is not set up in a way that reflects the community that I called you to be. And of course, the marker for that is the way that the poor, the widow, and this is especially in Isaiah 1 and 2, the poor, the widow, and the orphan, how you treat those people who have, why those people? Well, this is where the social part comes in, of course, because they have no connection to the patriarchal structure and are therefore pretty much, you know, destitute. If you don't care for them, then that's sort of the mark of your, of the degree to which you are reflecting the justice that I called you to practice. And Jesus, that's at the center of his message, this prophetic voice. And that's what I mean by the fact that he doesn't come at this issue with some kind of brand new ethic. He's very much, and in fact, he quotes the prophets. One of the most famous passages is, of course, from Luke, where he quotes Isaiah, Luke 4, where he quotes Isaiah. He said, "The spirit of," he gets up in the, you know, this, you all know this scene. He gets up in the synagogue and reads from Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free." And then, of course, he sits down and says, "Today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." So Jesus very much identified with the mission of the prophets. One of his favorite sayings in Matthew is, he says it at least a couple times, is, "I desire mercy, not," go and learn what this means, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Quoting from Hosea. And then probably the best, I want to look in just a little more detail at probably one of Jesus' most famous stories, the Good Samaritan, because I think we sometimes misread this as sort of not necessarily misread it, but we sometimes reduce it to that sentiment of love, that we're supposed to love people, even if they're not like us, you know. And that's okay, but the thing about the Good Samaritan is that what's interesting about it and what we sometimes forget is that Jesus very carefully chose the people who walked by the guy on the side of the road. You'll know the story, right? We're not telling the story. but I'm kind of forgetting some of the details. who is it who walks by? So this guy's going down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Priest and a Levite. Now, why did he choose a priest and a Levite? Why didn't he just choose, why was it important that it was a priest and a Levite that passed him by on the other side?
Because they're the top of the hierarchy.
Okay, they're the top of the hierarchy. So there's possibly an anti-disestablishmentarianism. Somebody threw that out to the hierarchy thing going on here.
And purity. I mean, I imagine there's the purity hierarchy.
Right.
The Kohanim and then the Levite.
Right. And so now let's. The thing is, I was in a production of Godspell once, and of course this is one of the parables that they stage. Although Godspell is supposed to be according to Matthew, but most of the parables are from Luke. I never could figure that out. But when the priest and the Levite come by, you know, the rest of the troop is supposed to boo, you know, and then the Samaritan comes by, yay! When of course the audience would be thinking just the opposite, right? The original audience of the parable. But what about the priest and the Levite? So they're concerned about purity. So does anyone want to take their side in this issue?
They're doing what they're supposed to do.
In what sense?
Well, the Samaritan's unclean.
Why?
Because he's wounded.
Well, yeah, it's not the Samaritan. We don't know the identity of the of the guy. You're right, right. But right. The Samaritan hasn't shown up yet, but your point is
right.
Still the same.
Right.
So say that again, I'm sorry.
Well, and he's unclean because he's bleeding.
Right, for one thing. He's obviously bleeding. They say they left him half dead, right? Yeah. And so he's what else?
Well, the Samaritan's coming out of Jerusalem, and the Levite is going into Jerusalem, most probably to be doing their temple duty, which is only once a year, is it?
Right.
So they would be, if they became unclean, they would not be able to fulfill their function and make their money.
Right. So there's something more going on here than just there being heartless buggers, right? They are making a choice as to what is it to be holy. To be holy is either, and this is the same dichotomy that the prophets brought out, that there are these two aspects of being holy. One of them is directly with God, right? And the other is manifested through horizontally, I guess you'd say. It's sort of like the way the Ten Commandments are laid out. The first table generally is seen to have to do with the direct relationship between human and God, right? Don't use God's name in vain, and don't have any other gods. And then the second table is seen to have to do with human-human relations. And of course, that's the way Jesus summarizes the law, right? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and your neighbor as yourself. So the question is, how do those two things relate? God commands both of those things. How do they relate? That is a debate that has been going on, as I said, since into the Hebrew Bible. And this story really taps into that debate. And it's of course the end of it says which one does the right thing? The Samaritan, by making himself unclean. First of all, of course, the choice of the Samaritan is not accidental either. The Samaritans were unclean.
To start with.
So that sort of adds fuel to the fire, and then you've got this rich symbolism of his bathing his wounds with oil and wine, which of course is what's used in sacrifices. So he's offering the right sacrifice. So Jesus is really taking a stance here on the side of the prophets, that what God requires, that when the ritual and the ethical come into conflict, that the ethical really should win out. I sometimes think of, this seems like such an obvious point, but I sometimes think of, this is one parable that definitely has some contemporary implications. When a congregation is say, faced with the decision whether to build a new organ or sponsor an inner city church or whatever, that doesn't God want us to worship God beautifully with beautiful music and all that? That's, God loves that and God commands that. But how does that work out with the other aspect, our other calling to social justice? It's a tough one. But Jesus, I don't think, is very ambiguous here. Comments, questions?
Well, I've never heard this story explained this way, but there is a way in which, Pam said, if they don't go to the temple to do their duties, they won't get paid. Well, I would assume that, but let's just assume that that's not the only reason they're going to the temple, right? That there is some...
Absolutely.
They are going to do a service.
To do what they think God wants them to
God.
Do. Absolutely.
I think that's the high holidays, that they're going to do the scapegoat and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
This is to make sure that this whole group of people are, maintain their relationship to God. So it's not, it's not as quite as simple as,
right.
Because there is a human-to-human piece of that.
Right.
And
right.
So... It's even
a genuine
more
conflict.
Yeah.
It's a genuine conflict.
So why? I guess the question is it? I don't know the Gospels that well, but is it that simple that Jesus every single case says that it's the human to human piece that is predominant? I mean, is there no ambiguity there, or just in the story?
Well, there's one. More or less that is one of definitely Jesus' themes, is that the ethical. If that's not the best way to divide it, the ethical versus ritual, but that the ethical, genuine, all the healing on the Sabbath that he did.
Right.
There's a great story when we talk about the healings, wonderful story that I sort of forgot about. I was reading Luke, sitting on that porch, and there's that wonderful story of Jesus healing the crippled woman, in Luke 13 on the Sabbath. It's, I mean, he breaks just about every social boundary with that one act. It's just
that's
a beautiful story.
Yeah.
But there is the one passage in the Sermon on the Mount where maybe some of you can think of it, what I'm thinking of, that has to do with where the ritual is sort of tied into the Jesus, I guess maybe it illustrates best that Jesus is not rejecting the ritual. You know, he healed the leper, and he said, go show yourself to the priest. That's part of it. Yeah.
Another one right at the beginning of Luke, Zechariah is a righteous and holy man.
Right.
He's priest.
He's the priest.
Doing his service in the
right.
temple. So
right.
that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder about when Jesus is having his feet anointed with oil,
mm-hmm.
and he says, I will, the poor will always be with you, but I will not always be with you.
Yeah.
Where does that play in?
That's a really good point. That plays in perfectly, and that's an example of where maybe it's safe to say that there were times that called for something more extravagant. That, I think that's a difficult one. It's a difficult passage. I've often had trouble with that passage. That there is a sense in which her devotion to him, of course, it was his head. At that, I mean, there's the two different stories. The one is the woman who bathes Jesus' feet with her tears while he's at dinner, and then I know exactly what you're saying. And then there's the other, that richly symbolic story of the woman anointing him before his burial, which of course is anointing him for his kingship and the way he's going to be. That's his anointing as king, and he's going to reign as king through his death and suffering. And there is a definitely dimension where devotion kind of supersedes in a very temporary sense. So I think that's a good... The one that I was thinking of, and I would be happy to hear responses to that, because I don't have an answer to that. But the one I was also thinking of is the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you know, before you offer your gift at the altar, if you have something, you know, something between you and your brother or sister that, you know, go reconcile and then bring your gift to the altar. He doesn't say the gift is not important, but there's where you see again that concern for the ritual and the ethical being in the proper balance.
Well, this part of the parable, he's answering a question that the lawyers posed to him, at least the New Revised Standard Says, to test him.
Right.
About, you know, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And so he asks him back, he says, what are the two most important laws?
Right.
And I think that's the insight, at least for me, and the Good Samaritan. He says, you know, to love God and to love your neighbor. And then he says, well, who is my neighbor?
Right.
And I think there might be an inherent nature to say, well, my neighbors are the people I know,
right,
who are Jews.
Absolutely.
Those Samaritans that live down the road,
right,
well, they're not really my neighbors because
right,
they're unclean. And so right, maybe part of it is trying to get the broader sense of your neighbors are more than you think.
Right, right. That's another parable where social boundaries, you know, this is what Jesus, another fundamental piece of Jesus' ministry was to break down social boundaries. So to use the Samaritan as an example, it's kind of a tricky parable in its context. It's one of the reasons that some people, you know, even though it's sort of it's the only place that parable shows up. So by historical standards, that's, you know, not the best evidence that Jesus actually told it. But most people say this is so close to the heart of Jesus' message. But you can also see some of the tension. You can see that Luke probably is the one who put that parable with that dialogue, because the lawyer asks, who is my neighbor? And the parable really doesn't answer that question, because it's more who proved to be a neighbor is the question that asked the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan. Who proved? It's a whole different question. And then, of course, you've got the fact that Luke probably took that setting from. He doesn't have that question come up in the temple as it is in Matthew and Mark. So he probably took that dispute about, you know, what are the greatest commandments, and put it in a different setting, and then use that parable to illustrate that. I don't know why that's important, but I think the importance is, to me, it's that the parable. To me, that's evidence that the parable certainly predated Luke's gospel and probably goes back to Jesus himself. There was another hand over here.
Well, part of what he seems to be saying to me is ritual. What's the purpose of ritual?
Mm-hmm.
Is the purpose of ritual to help you along on your spiritual path?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, in this case, a barrier to learning more? And it seems like in his day, ritual had become a barrier to actually pursuing a spiritual path.
But in those days, that wasn't even a question, right? It was obedience to God. It wasn't what the purpose of this is. God commanded.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a question of balance, that things can easily get out of balance. There's no religion. I mean, this is an element of all religions, ritual and ethical practice. And I think it's really, we really have to be careful about ascribing, you know, ritual to Jews or to Catholics or whatever, and saying that ritual itself is the problem. I think you put it really nicely, that ritual can sort of get out of balance. It can get in the way. It can enhance or it can get in the way of living out what God wills for us. And you know, it's the balancing act, and it's that's where you need a prophetic voice, and that's how Jesus functions. Is the prophetic voice is the one who's calling us to say, does this practice or does this particular decision, you know, what values does it reflect? Does it truly reflect the values of God, of God's kingdom, or something else? Or is it in
We talked about yesterday how Jesus' actions, along with his words and stories, teach what he wants us to know about living together.
Yeah.
And this story could also be read as a kind of a prophetic picture of Jesus' own career. The story of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he looks upon, just like God in the Old Testament, he hears the cry, looks upon the downtrodden, he bends down, he pours out what he has for them, and takes them to a place, you could even know, he can allegorize the whole thing, which was done by the ancients.
Yeah.
And he will come again.
Right.
The whole thing is sort of in that story too.
And then you could also put the scandalous aspect of it, that it's a Samaritan, that it's a way that was totally unexpected. That's a big part of why Jesus, you know, in the Gospels anyway, why Jesus is rejected as Messiah, is because, you know, he can't be the Messiah. Because of the shape of his life and the things that he actually said and did don't qualify him to be the Messiah that we're expecting. So there's also that part of it. Peter, you had your hand up before.
This is just in response to this, but the Messiah previous to Jesus was the most scandalous person we could think of.
Say that again.
David, the Messiah, was as scandalous as we could think of, of a person. I mean, Jesus' scandals are somewhat questionable, debatable in the Gospels, but David's, there's no debating that Davis was a scandalous character.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is, until Jesus, the Messiah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I love about this parable how the Samaritan, he goes out of his way. You know, he's obviously journeying, but in his interest in helping the injured man, he goes out of his way, stops his journey, actually, takes a detour, and goes to an inn, and he's like leveraging his relationship with the innkeeper, someone he knows, and says, you know, take care of this man, when I come back, I'll make sure that I repay you, you know, anything that you need in relation to his care. I think the piece that I really love is that.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a challenge that we sort of started with, the challenge of this parable is so well known, and it kind of gives us all kind of neat feelings, but it's a very challenging parable, very radical in what it's calling us to do. It's not just about, you know, it's calling us to some very radical decisions and radical courses of action. Rolf, you had your hand up before.
I was wondering, what do we know? I was thinking about the story that somebody mentioned where Jesus helped a woman on the Sabbath.
Yeah. That was me who mentioned that, by the way.
I knew it was somebody.
We can replay the tape. I'll prove it to you.
This thought just occurred to me. I'm just wondering, what do we know about how Jesus knew what to do in situations like that? I mean, suddenly he's confronted with the situation. And he had to make that decision mm-hmm. somehow, just like we do on the fly when we're moving through life.
Right.
What do we know about how he made that decision? How did he know what to do?
Right. Well, we know, I think that's a really neat question. We know that, I mean, of course, on one level, it would be a simple answer. Well, he was God, right? Well, yeah, that's the easy way. that's the easy way because I mean, we can. That's a whole other discussion. But I, for one, don't think that Jesus was conscious of being God, and possibly not even conscious of being the Messiah. To me, that would sort of vitiate whatever value it was that he was human. If he knew he was God and was just sort of pretending, you know, building a sort of Lego humanity. But I mean, he was steeped in the Scripture. We know that he was steeped in the. He read the prophets, obviously. Or had them read to him. I mean, there's some question about whether Jesus was literate, but it was an oral society, so he knew them, or he knew them orally, and I think that's a huge, and he had a hermeneutic. That's the thing about. I mean, he had an interpretive principle, and that was that there is a central command by which all others must be measured, you know, if we look at that in chapter 13 that. I'll just read this. That'll be a good way to conclude, actually, and we can maybe unpack it a little more tomorrow. Sorry, I have other plans for tomorrow. And tomorrow this class is at 6, I think. So it is. That's not supposed to be funny. Jesus was teaching in the synagogue. Just listen. Keep a list as you hear this story of how many taboos. And how many social and religious, I guess political is maybe in there, boundaries Jesus violates in this story. Now he was teaching, he being Jesus, I assume. Yep. Was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment." And when he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" When he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things that he was doing. Isn't that a great story? Well, we're told that we're supposed to quit on time. Let's just take a couple minutes here to unpack that a little bit. What sort of taboos do you see Jesus breaking there? What sort of challenges to the prevailing social and religious ethic do you see Jesus kind of taking on in that parable?
Well, he brought a woman into probably a place where only men were hanging.
Absolutely.
Listening.
Absolutely.
That's the first thing.
Yep, absolutely. And that's something we've got to talk about at some point, is maybe when we talk about sexuality. But Jesus' attitude towards women was genuinely offensive to most, and definitely challenging of the present social order. Yeah, to bring a woman into the center of the synagogue and talk to her.
And then speak to her and then touch her.
Right, and then touch her. Right.
And she was sick.
Yeah, right, and she was sick. And why was she sick?
She was possessed.
Yeah, well, that's Jesus' interpretation, of course. He ascribes it to Satan. But who might, you know, what else might you ascribe it to? Again, thinking of our understanding,
wasn't righteous enough.
Right, she wasn't.
So
right.
God was not standing on her.
Right. Oh, this yeah. is. So she's. I guess. I mean, maybe not technically unclean, but she's definitely one of the. You know, she's outside of the sphere. She, you know, outside of God's mercy. Jesus brings her in, and heals her. And in that sense, and I think this is the way to think about Jesus. I don't think Jesus was anti-holiness. I think Jesus' understanding of holiness was different. His idea was more to instead of keeping out what was unholy, was to reach out to what was unholy and make it holy, and bring it in. I mean, so many of his miracles had to do with bringing people in. So many of his healings had to do with bringing people in, like the woman with the flow of blood. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, outcast. She would be ritually unclean. She would be on the outskirts of society. The man with the unclean spirit who lived among the tombs, and of course Gentiles. He healed Gentiles as well. Sometimes he had to be convinced of that. Another story that we'll have to look at, because it really is my favorite, is the Syrophoenician woman who kind of teaches Jesus a lesson. I love that story in Mark 7. But so there's so much going on in his healings that has social and even political dimensions. Anything else? What's interesting, of course, too, is that he doesn't say the Sabbath is stupid. He argues in a very rabbinic way. He argues from the lesser to the greater. Well, you take care of your donkey and your what does he say?
Ox
on the Sabbath, right? Well, how much more should then, you know, and you don't break the Sabbath when you do that, right? How much more? So what's interesting is that you see Jesus engaging in arguments. Back to your question, Rolf. He's got a sense of what the scriptures are about, and I certainly can't say, you know, why he has that, but it's certainly he's steeped in them.
Well, he's certainly not following the letter of any law.
Right. No.
And so he, what that tells me is that following the letter of some law is not going to be helpful to us either.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, it can get us in trouble.
Right.
And so what I'm asking is, what are we left with then?
Yeah.
As a human being, as we're going through life on a day-to-day basis, we run into ethical dilemmas all the time.
Right, right.
And we don't have time to go and refer to a written code of ethics when we're operating on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't
think Jesus did either. It sounds to me like he was able to, in the moment, access personal wisdom and clarity that gave him the confidence to act with courage in the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about cultivating a virtue, really. I would describe those as virtues that need to be cultivated. I think one of the things that we need to emphasize is that Jesus called people, and this is all here. We can stay another hour, can't we? Jesus, this is only my first point. Jesus was a prophet. there are a few things more. Well, we did get into Jesus as healer, but Jesus as sort of egalitarian, certainly anti-patriarchal. Those are all things on my list here. But now I lost my train of thought. Virtue that Jesus called people into community, and that is a crucial part of what he did. His was not an individual ethic. It wasn't like you're out there on your own. You make these ethical choices. He called people into a community that's I think where you get that, a community that reflects the values of the kingdom that nurtures those, and that's where again I think ritual can serve to actually support that as well, so that when you, I think it's a great way to describe it, when you get in a situation, you have this intuitive sense of what the right thing is to do. I mean, I'm not describing how that happens, but, and of course, communities can also go awry, but...
And he wasn't operating in that kind of community, was he? I mean,
well, he was trying
kind
to...
of operating on the edge of historical community and maybe a new future community,
right?
But he didn't actually have that community at that time, did he?
Well, I think he was trying to found a movement, he called at least 12 people to be with him.
He was part of a community of 12 at least.
Yeah, and certainly more than that. We're part of, he called whoever does the will of my father is my brother and sister and actually, what's interesting about that text in Mark 3, he doesn't say father. You know, this is the relativizing of family. It's part of the community thing. For Jesus, family was subordinate to, as I said at the beginning, family was subordinate to, or family ties are subordinate to the call of the kingdom. And it's when his mother and brothers are coming to get him, because everyone's saying he's crazy. I love that passage in Mark. Matthew takes that out, not surprisingly. But and his family heard it, but they went to restrain him, for people were saying he's gone out of his mind. and he was told that his family's outside, and then he says, your mother and your brothers and sisters are outside asking for you. And he said, who are my mother and my brothers? And he looked, and looking at those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Notice he doesn't say father. It's kind of interesting. I think that's part of it. That's a big part of it, is that you're not just out there, the lone ethical ranger. And part of it is forming. If you've ever read the works of Stanley Hauerwas, by the way, I was going to go through some resources, but I won't. Be happy to afterwards. But Hauerwas was big on that sort of Christian community as a place to form virtue, so that you can make these kinds of decisions.
I think it's really important when we start talking about communities to understand that there was not, as often as presented in the Gospels and in many of the texts that secondary texts that deal with them, or in the Hebrew Bible for that matter, the religious community and outside. There were many gradations and many alternative communities to which people belonged, and many ways that people dealt with their religious life parallel to the official
right.
picture that we get in the scriptural text.
Are you talking about Christian, quote unquote, or are you talking about in general?
I'm talking about in general, but certainly in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament,
right.
there are communities, there are women's ways of being religious that are not recorded, for example, in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in the New Testament as
yep,
well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think in response to the question about how we know is that there's another balance I think that Jesus is calling us to, and it's not only calling us to community, but calling to community. Or we've all been called too much. But called to a contemplative life as well, because there were times in his ministry when
yeah.
he left
yeah.
for an extended period of time
yeah.
and pondered the,
yeah.
the laws of the universe
yeah.
that prepared him for when he went back into community. So
yeah.
for me anyway, that's how I always think he was so grounded in what he could do, is because he had spent time
yeah, that's
in
nice.
Contemplation.
Mm-hmm. That's very nice, yeah. And that's certainly a nice way to end, because that's, of course, what we're here to do. So thank you for your thoughts. Sorry we didn't get through as much as I wanted to, but tomorrow we'll maybe pick up a little of this, but we'll talk specifically about the whole issue of violence, nonviolence. So bring your violins. Sex. Right, exactly.